Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. While still in the throes of the coronavirus pandemic, many other health issues have taken a backseat to COVID-19 and all of society's alterations around it. Moreover, periods of struggle can lead people to self-medicate, and as listeners know, one of the most discussed epidemics in the United States over the last decade, prior to coronavirus, is the opioid epidemic. With the invention and marketing of the drug OxyContin in the mid-1990s, opioid use continuously climbed in the United States to the point that we now see life expectancy for non-college-educated whites declining over each of the last 3 years, with those persons dying from what some observers call deaths of despair. My guest today, Nancy Campbell, has written a new book on the history of the opioid reversal agent naloxone, which is also known as Narcan. Titled OD, Naloxone and the Politics of Overdose, Campbell takes us through the 20th century discovery of the drug and its evolution as a tool of emergency room reanimation to its spread as a harm reduction strategy such that it is now available over-the-counter in many U.S. jurisdictions. Nancy Campbell is a professor and the department head of science and technology studies at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York. She's my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Professor Nancy Campbell, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start very basic, and I'd love it if you could just tell us what naloxone is and what it's used for.
So naloxone is a narcotic antagonist, and what that means is that if you're in an overdose situation, you've got opioids in your system, and you get a dose of naloxone, that naloxone has a greater affinity for your opiate receptors in your brain, and it will kick off whatever opioids are on those receptors at the time. So naloxone has the capacity to reverse an opioid overdose, which means really that it will restart breathing.
And, you know, your book is really fascinating because it goes into the history of this, which is history that I certainly did not know. For example, prior to naloxone, there was a drug called nalorphine, which was sort of the prototype for this. But that drug, which was used, interestingly, in a variety of settings, I guess, could you talk a little bit about that and why it didn't, in your opinion, why you think it didn't really work?
Yeah, so nalorphine, or Naline, as Merck called it when they marketed it, was actually used by police departments. The idea was that you could use Naline or nalorphine to detect whether someone was using opioids. And so it was used almost as a bioassay in order to test whether someone had recently used opioids. And it was administered, in particular, it started in Oakland in the Alameda County Police Department in Oakland, California. And they created a special testing room where they could administer it. It was given as a shot. And then they could sit somebody down in a chair, like a dentist chair, and they could measure their pupils and how their pupils responded to the administration of this narcotic antagonist, the first narcotic antagonist that was used in this manner. And that drug was used widely on the West Coast, but also in police departments in other cities. It was used during the 50s and the 60s and into the 70s. Now, naloxone was synthesized in the early 60s, and it was approved to reverse opioid overdoses by the FDA in 1971. But even so, it was nalorphine that was already out there, and so it really gradually displaced nalorphine, even though naloxone is a much better, much more accurate narcotic antagonist. In other words, nalorphine always had some effects other than reversing an opioid overdose. Naloxone doesn't have those effects. It's what a pharmacologist would call clean. And so it doesn't have extra effects.
What were some of those extra effects of nalorphine?
Yeah, so nalorphine, and so many of these opioid antagonists, these narcotic antagonists, are mixed agonist antagonists, which means that they have some analgesic effects. They have some effects like an agonist, like methadone or morphine, for that matter, or OxyContin or any of the other opioids that we're familiar with. They are agonists. And so if you have some agonist effects and some antagonist effects, you usually have a drug that's kind of sloppy. In other words, it has lots of different effects and people can't quite tell how to use it. The reason people were excited about naloxone was because it was a very pure antagonist. It had no agonist effects. It has no effect on anyone if the person does not have an opioid already in their system. So naloxone, in other words, is a very clearly antagonistic drug.
So this sounds very crude, but in medical school we learned that an agonist is like a key to a lock, and it works to at the level of the receptor for the drug to take effect. And an antagonist is just that, a blocker. It sort of blocks the effect. So there are these drugs that are mixed that have some of the effects of the drug, but also then block some of the effects of the drug. So as you point out, it doesn't lead to those clean effects. So you mentioned something that's pretty interesting, that naloxone, the newer drug or the drug we use today, was actually discovered in 1960, in a character that you introduced us to in the book, Jack Fishman, I'd never heard of, who I guess discovered the drug and really didn't know what he had and wound up working in pharmaceutical and research until I guess he died in 2013, but didn't really have any knowledge of sort of what he'd helped create. Why did it take so long to get FDA approval for this drug?
Well, it didn't take that long. They just didn't see a market for it. Endopharmaceuticals, for whom Fishman did not work, he was kind of moonlighting. A very interesting story of that. But they didn't really perceive a market. And when naloxone was approved in 1971, the only people who used it were anesthesiologists in operating rooms or people in emergency medicine. And you have to understand that at that time, emergency medicine was quite new in this country. So naloxone was put on what we would call basic and advanced medical trucks. And so EMTs and paramedics had access to naloxone. No one else did. So the real story of your question, what took so long, is the story I'm trying to tell in the book. It's a story about a social movement, the harm reduction social movement, that hasn't even begun in the 1970s. It really did not come online until all of the activism around HIV and AIDS started to take place, and people began to realize that we needed to do something to reduce the harm of needle-based IV drug transmission of HIV. And so needle exchange was one of the first harm reduction tactics and practices that people began to adopt. And so the story of naloxone is really a story in which social movement activists have to work really, really hard to get naloxone out of the medical context and into the hands of people who might be likely to witness an overdose. That takes decades, and it takes a lot of imagination on the part of the activists themselves, and also it takes changes to law and policy and a real mind shift, I would say, in medicine itself and in public health.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Nancy Campbell, who is a professor and head of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York. She's the author of a brand new book called OD, Naloxone and the Politics of Overdose, which is just out. And we were talking a little bit about how the thesis of your book, really, which is that naloxone is part of a harm reduction strategy. I loved the early part, the history of how naloxone kind of came into use. And as you point out, in the 1970s, started to be used in emergency departments. There was this whole idea of reanimatology. I guess, could you just comment on what that is?
Right. So reanimatology was actually a clinical science that was practiced, believe it or not, in Soviet Russia. But I was really interested and really struck by this metaphor of reanimatology and what it meant to animate a technology like naloxone. Naloxone has kind of had nine lives. It's meant different things to different groups of people. And today, of course, in the midst of an opioid overdose death epidemic, we should always remember that that is an ongoing problem. Even as we think about our current coronavirus epidemic, we have to remember the other epidemic, the fact that we have not turned the corner yet on opioid overdose deaths, despite getting naloxone out to more and more people. So the idea of reanimatology was I began to get very curious about other kinds of first aid measures like CPR that dealt with people saving the lives of others and good Samaritans and people who would come upon an accident situation and act out of concern for others. And so I was very interested in that and looking at sciences and also looking at clinicians who made protocols for CPR and for emergency medicine in general, and how they began to acquire knowledge. To whom did they turn? And what kinds of knowledges helped them figure out the various ways in which we might reanimate someone who has died? And so I got very interested in that as I was writing this book, in part because I wanted to enliven people's imagination about the ways in which medicine and a technology like naloxone, which I call a technology of solidarity throughout the book, might be used to say something different about our relationships with one another. I think that the opioid overdose situation is a signal. It signals something about our way of life. And if we can turn it towards altruism and turn it towards feeling responsible for one another's lives and one another's deaths, I think that we might be able to do something different other than just allow the overdose death rate to continue to climb without intervening.
Well, one thing you pointed out in the book that I guess I should have been aware of but wasn't is that there are whole YouTube channels, I guess, dedicated to this idea of watching people overdose and or become reanimated with the dosing of naloxone or Narcan. I mean, is it just the fascination with this for seeing, you know, people who don't use opioids to try to understand what's going on?
I think there is a widespread attempt on the part of many people in our society to try to understand why so many people feel that they need opioids, and therefore why so many people get themselves into this kind of situation where they might be overdosing, they might overdose in a public place. When I first started writing the book, it took me about 7 years to write this book and to research and to interview. And during that time, there were basically, when I began, very few public representations of overdose and very few what I might call cultural artifacts around overdose. By the time I finished the book, there were whole YouTube channels. There were oftentimes police or sheriff's department would start taking cell phone videos of people overdosing and upload those ostensibly to prevent others from overdosing, to kind of create a knowledge base. But in so many ways, the activists, the harm reduction activists, they had the most accurate and pragmatic way of looking at overdose, and their voices were not being heard at the same level. Now I would say they've been able to get their message out in a big way. I begin the book actually with a T-shirt from the UK, Keep Calm and Carry Naloxone, playing with the British slogan, Keep Calm and Carry On. And I think that there's been a widespread attempt on the part of the harm reduction activists to really give people knowledge about what to do in the case of an overdose and how to respond to an overdose, how to recognize that one is going on, and how to intervene in one. Hopefully people will do that with a supply of naloxone, because it's a lot easier to achieve a reversal if you have naloxone on you than if you're not carrying naloxone. And so I think that the public representations, which include things like obituaries now and many documentaries and television shows and radio shows, I think that we now have a much more robust public sphere around the question of naloxone. We can no longer say it's marginalized. It's still stigmatized, but there's much more of a cultural conversation about overdose and about overdose prevention that we now have a chance really to get that message out much more fully.
And it's so interesting about your personal journey with the 7 years working on the book that there were really, you know, not many cultural artifacts and now, you know, quite a few of them out there. I want to, for our listeners' sake, talk about the concept of harm reduction, because I think for people in healthcare or activism and many other social movements, it's a pretty common concept, but it's not something I think that's intuitive. So you mentioned how naloxone use grew out of AIDS activism in the 1980s, where the concept of harm reduction really sort of flourished with needle exchange. And I guess I wondered if you'd recount, you know, what that history is, or sort of more broadly what the concept of harm reduction is.
Yeah, so the idea of harm reduction, actually, in some ways, it is quite intuitive from a public health perspective, because you have to look at what are the specific practices that are amplifying harm in any given social situation. And it began really with people in, I've tried to argue that there are indigenous harm reduction practices in the United States, but the conventional narrative is that harm reduction began in Northern England and in Rotterdam and Liverpool, in places where people were beginning already to think about bloodborne virus transmission. Even before HIV, there was some harm reduction activism around hepatitis C. So those practices began to evolve, and they were often drug users themselves who were seeking a more dignified and less stigmatized form of health and health care. And what was interesting in the United States, it was sometimes called harm minimization. And the U.S. government was, especially during the Reagan administration, when HIV first began to be recognized as something that was happening, was really against harm reduction. And so it's always been curious to me today to talk to people in New York City or in Chicago or in San Francisco or in places where harm reduction was really imported. And they will often speak as if harm reduction, everyone believes harm reduction works. It's a widespread public discourse. It's even integrated now into public health in a way that it has rarely been. So it's a new time in a lot of ways for harm reduction. But harm reduction is very pragmatic. It consists of really thinking about what are the specific harms that could occur in a situation, and is there anything that I can do to help mitigate them, to help reduce them, to help them be less of a factor. So needle exchange occurred in the late 1980s, and this was the hardest part to tell you the truth about writing this book, was that many of these practices occurred simultaneously in different places. And so you have people who are organizing around Seattle and Tacoma. You have people who are organizing in San Francisco. You have people who are organizing in New York and Chicago. And they're all doing slightly different things, but they're doing it around the idea of dignity, of meeting people where they're at, of providing people with a concrete tool to reduce harm. And in the case of HIV, that concrete tool was clean needles. And so what happened was that needle exchanges were organized, and then antiretrovirals became more available to more people. And so people began to live with AIDS. They began to live in ways that they hadn't been able to live before. And they were concerned, in other words, always about dying of AIDS. And so now people are living with AIDS, and that is changing what harm reduction means, because what's happening is that people are living with AIDS, but they're dying of overdose. And especially among young people, there began to be a realization that overdose was becoming more and more of a concern, that more of the people they knew were dying of overdose, that people were having quite a few overdoses before they died. One thing that people often don't know is that people often have 9 overdoses before the 10th one kills them. And so there are many, many opportunities to intervene in the trajectory, right, of someone who's using opioids. And so the harm reduction movement began to realize, oh, there is this thing called naloxone. And people began to realize that if they could get their hands on naloxone, which often took a lot of ingenuity because naloxone was entirely held within the emergency medical system and within operating rooms. And so it was very difficult for activists at first to figure out how to, in a sense, liberate naloxone from the various places where it was. And if you think about that, no doctor, no physician was going to prescribe naloxone at that point in time. No physician was going to write somebody out a prescription, even if they had written them a prescription for high-dose opioids. No physician knew to write out a prescription for naloxone. Very few people were making that connection. And so from 1971 onto well into the 1990s, near the mid to late 1990s, naloxone was held entirely within the medical enclave, within emergency medicine and the surgical suite. And so what was very interesting to me was the harm reduction activists' imagination. What would it mean if we could make a deal with manufacturers of naloxone to buy it in bulk and start giving it out to people? What would it mean to give naloxone to people who are drug users themselves, highly likely to witness an overdose, in relationships with partners who are opioid users? So they begin to think about the meaning of that, and it's really their intervention. They are the ones who think up, well, okay, maybe we could get a physician who would write a standing order that would allow us to prescribe naloxone not to an individual, but to any individual who came into our needle exchange and expressed interest in being able to save someone's life if they overdose. And so they come up with lots of different schemes. In various places, they try various things. Researchers start getting involved. This movement is very evidence-based. This movement worked from the very beginning with researchers because they began to realize that they, for one thing, they would like to have naloxone over the counter. For another thing, they realized that they were going to have to find legal mechanisms by which they could get naloxone out, and also legal mechanisms so that bystanders would not be held legally accountable if someone did die and they tried to save their life with naloxone. These are called Good Samaritan laws. And nowadays, almost all states have either revised their Good Samaritan laws or their naloxone access laws. Within the United States, that's happening, but that's also happening across the globe. So there are really interesting global naloxone distribution projects as well. And in the book, I talk a lot about Scotland because it was the one place that had a national naloxone program where they really tried to get naloxone out to almost everyone who needed it, because so many families in Scotland have had their lives touched by overdose deaths.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Nancy Campbell, who is professor and head of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York. She's the author of a new book called OD, Naloxone and the Politics of Overdose. And we're talking about how the use of naloxone has become more widespread through harm reduction strategies from activists. And Nancy, you mentioned Scotland. So how does what they're doing in the UK differ from what we have in the United States?
What's interesting about the UK is that they're doing something different. They did something very different in Scotland than they did in England. In England, even though Liverpool was maybe the origin point for the harm reduction movement, in England it's still what they call a postcode lottery as to whether you will or will not have access to naloxone. So their naloxone distribution efforts are much lower in England in many ways than they were in Scotland, although one of the leading proponents of naloxone in the world, Sir John Strang, is from London. And so we see the paradox of a nation like Scotland, which interestingly, of course, has its own parliament, so it can act differently than England. And they decided to create a national naloxone program, and they poured a lot of money and energy into working with drug users themselves, with drug user groups, and also with pharmacists. And they also have something that we don't have in the United States. They have harm reduction nurses. So they have a healthcare system, the national healthcare system, where harm reduction is incorporated into it to such an extent that people have job titles like harm reduction nurses. I visited some of those places and learned how they were getting naloxone out to people. Also, people can go right into pharmacies and ask for naloxone, and they will be immediately shown into a small room and given it. And a pharmacist will have a conversation with them about do they have any questions about how to use it. In other words, naloxone has been destigmatized there in a way that I think we still have some ways to go here in the United States. And so I think it's a really different world in so many ways. In some places in the United States, harm reduction is well accepted and is well distributed. But at the same time, we still have a lot of moral issues, moral stigma surrounding addiction, surrounding the use of opioids, and surrounding harm reduction. And so I think that this gives us an opportunity as a nation to really say, come to terms in a lot of ways with the idea of harm reduction. I tried to write the book, the conclusion is a call for harm reduction infrastructure and for us to infuse harm reduction into our healthcare system. So I think that there shouldn't be a difference between harm reduction organizations and healthcare, that primary care should be delivered with harm reduction in mind. So co-prescribing naloxone, if you're a physician who has prescribed high-dose opioids to any patient, whether they are a pain patient or whether they are not, I think the other important thing about harm reduction is people need to recognize that abstinence from opioids, which a lot of recovery-oriented communities are promoting, is a risk factor for opioid overdose death. In other words, if you abstain from opioids and you've been tolerant to them, and then you go back to using them, you relapse, you're at higher risk for an opioid overdose death. And so I think that the harm reduction movement has been able to begin to educate people about that and begin to get some of that knowledge and some of that pharmacological imagination out into the world in ways that hopefully will indeed save people's lives.
Well, the research is very comprehensive, and it is really an incredible set of stories and history of opioids and opioid reversal in the United States and to some extent in Great Britain. The name of the book is OD, Naloxone and the Politics of Overdose, and it was written by my guest today, Nancy Campbell, who is a professor and head of the Department of Science and Technology at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York. Nancy Campbell, thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. Please stay safe out there, wash your hands, and keep your distance. Take care. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.